Legal Face-Off on WGNRadio.com is brought to you by McCorkle Litigation Services, leaders in court reporting and legal technology.
Hey, what's up, y'all? It's your man Montel Jordan, and this is how we do it. And right now, you're listening to Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio. That's right. You're locked onto the high-energy legal podcast with lawyers Rich Lenkov and Tina Martini, and they're going to be trading jabs on the breaking news and the hottest issues, sports, entertainment, politics. Nothing is off limits. Keep listening, because this is how we do it.
Welcome to another edition of Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio. We have Rich Lenkov from Downey & Lenkov. Tina Martini of McDermott, Will & Emery, as we say in the business, is on assignment this week. I'm your moderator, Ryan Burrow. Deborah Witzberg is the Inspector General for the City of Chicago. She's held that role since 2022, and recently she laid out a series of what she considers obstructions by the city's law department. She's got ideas on improving that. Repeat guest, by the way. Thanks for joining us again on Legal Face-Off.
Thanks for having me.
Always appreciate you having you coming on and updating our viewers and listeners. You've been busy. Your office has been in the news. So we're going to get right to the first issue, which is a 14-page letter that was addressed to the head of the City Council's Ethics Committee that accused current mayor of Chicago, Brandon Johnson, and other mayors of selectively impeding investigations by withholding records, slow walking compliance with your office's subpoenas, and demanding that lawyers be allowed to attend confidential investigative interviews. Explain to us what you're getting at here.
So this came about in response to some public comments and to some questions that came up in a hearing of the City Council's Committee on Ethics and Government Oversight. Those questions had to do with whether there are practices in city government that impact the effectiveness or the timeliness of OIG investigations. And I think there are three. I think there are three longstanding practices which profoundly threaten the independence and the effectiveness and the timeliness of our work. And those are the three things that you just mentioned. They have to do with the enforcement of OIG's subpoenas. So I'll take each one of these quickly, if that's okay. So OIG has authority to issue administrative subpoenas in the course of our investigative work. If someone fails to comply with one of those subpoenas, our remedy is that we sue to enforce. The law department, the city's law department, has interpreted the current language of the municipal code to say that they can choose which subpoenas we may enforce and which we may not enforce on the basis of whom they believe we are investigating. That would allow the law department to cripple investigations into some people of their choosing. Can't have it that way. The second issue has to do with the law department asserting attorney-client privilege, a notion that operates very, very differently in the government context than it does in the private client world. So this issue has to do with the law department asserting attorney-client privilege to prevent us from reviewing certain city records. Now, the law department is counsel for the City of Chicago and all of its components, including us. And the law on this point is clear, both on the federal level and as well as a matter of national standards. The issue here is that privilege is frankly being used as a synonym for unflattering. And so when there is information in city records that risks embarrassment to City Hall, we are being blocked from viewing those records. So that's the second issue. The third has to do with demands from the mayor's lawyers to sit in on confidential OIG investigative interviews. I think as a sort of common sense assessment, we cannot expect people to be as candid as they would otherwise be with the mayor's lawyers staring them down from across the table. And I think it is wholly inappropriate to subject whistleblowers and complainants and witnesses and subjects, for that matter, who cooperate in those interviews as a condition of their employment to be sort of monitored by the mayor's lawyers as they do so. So those are the three practices that we have identified. Those meaningfully obstruct and delay our work. They are impairments to OIG's independence. And so we've proposed amendments to the municipal code to address each one of those three changes. And I should say, I'm sorry for the monologue here. The last thing I will say quickly is that, you know, the changes we have proposed are simply to bring Chicago's municipal code into alignment with the national standards and the federal law on independent IG investigations.
Now, Inspector General, in an era when the executive branch of the federal government seems to be asserting itself more than ever and forgetting apparently that there are co-equal branches of government at that level, how has the executive branch of the local government reacted, and how has the Ethics Committee reacted to your letter?
Chairman Martin of the Ethics Committee has been has been very helpful and very supportive. He has introduced an ordinance into City Council, which precisely reflects our proposals, our proposed amendments. That was introduced into City Council this week. On Wednesday, that ordinance was sent to the Rules Committee, which, as you know, is a parliamentary maneuver, which is frequently used in City Council to delay, to stall an ordinance. That is very disappointing. The mayor's office has issued a public statement of their opposition to these changes. We should make no mistake. Obstruction of effective oversight here in Chicago absolutely should be understood against the backdrop of obstruction and undermining of effective oversight on the federal landscape. This is a local flavor of a national problem.
So speaking of that, you know, Trump dismissed very early on in this mere 30 days he's been in office. It seems like a lot longer, but he dismissed 18 inspector generals across a whole wide range of federal offices. You know, very quickly, I mean, our listeners and viewers know what you do, know the great work your office does, but what does an inspector general do at the federal level of these different agencies, and why is it a problem that Trump fired them?
Well, different OIGs are set up a little bit differently and have slightly different mandates, but in general, the role of an IG is to conduct independent oversight, to conduct independent work to root out misconduct, fraud, and waste in the agencies they oversee. And the independence is key there. That is the lifeblood and the hallmark of effective oversight work. The idea is that we must be able to do our work and to pursue facts where they take us without fear or favor. That's what IG independence is all about.
And what effect on that role and function do you think firing these 18 others, who, by the way, as we've covered, have some of them have filed lawsuits, what effect do you think it has on the ability to do that job?
I mean, it's profoundly undermining and destabilizing.
Okay. Let's turn to back to local politics. We'd be remiss if we didn't have you comment, even though it's a little bit outside of your personal jurisdiction. Your thoughts on Michael Madigan, the verdict for the longest serving House Speaker in U.S. history here in Illinois, and also the pardoning by Trump of Blagojevich. How does that affect what you're trying to do on a local level?
Well, you know, Chicago has long earned its reputation on government corruption. You know, the Chicago way is a proper noun and not in a good way. It's not a compliment. And I think that those two cases are reminders that we operate, this city runs very much with the weight of all of its history. The city of Chicago has spent generations operating at a deficit of legitimacy with its residents. For generations, the city has given Chicagoans no reason to trust City Hall, no reason to give City Hall the benefit of the doubt. The conviction of Michael Madigan was a stark reminder of how deeply entrenched corruption is and has been in Chicago and in Illinois. And I think that the pardon of Governor Blagojevich is a reminder of how hard it is to bend back this long arc of misconduct and mistrust in government. I think no one should look out at this landscape in Chicago and Illinois right now and think that the status quo is enough when it comes to government accountability. All of that, again, is a backdrop for our work in trying to protect effective and independent oversight.
Inspector General, we've been lucky enough to have you on our program many times over the course of 10 years that we've been on. And we've never mentioned these words, I think, when we've had you on. Hugo Boss cufflinks, Givenchy, Gucci, Kate Spade handbags, size 14 men's shoes. What do all these terms have in common? They were all found in at least the YouTube video that we saw of Mayor Brandon Johnson's gift room, gift closet. Now, we saw that video because of the investigation done by your office. Number one, what is the significance of that? Number two, why is it only on video? Why can't we as a general public and taxpayers go into this room and see all of this and many other things that were in there that were given to the mayor? And I guess my third question is, why doesn't this violate the law prohibiting accepting these kind of gifts?
Well, I'll say first, Rich, if you can find all of those items on that video, you have better eyes than I do. I'm not sure any of us, I'm not sure that we can see all of those items on the video. But you, of course, are referring to some work we did recently around the mayor's accepting certain gifts on behalf of the city. So there are rules prohibiting acceptance of gifts by city officials, except under certain circumstances. One of the circumstances under which gifts can be accepted is, quote unquote, on behalf of the city. And this provision of the law is designed to allow for things like you know, ceremonial gifts from visiting dignitaries or public art or whatever the case may be. And the law, the ethics ordinance says that if a city official accepts a gift on behalf of the city, it has to be publicly reported and added to an inventory of the city's property. In the course of doing some investigative work, we found that going back to the administration of Mayor Sawyer, that practice had not applied to the mayor. There had been an unwritten understanding, never a good sign in government ethics, an unwritten understanding, that instead of doing the public reporting, the mayor's office could simply write these gifts down in a physical logbook that would be available on the fifth floor of City Hall to members of the public who wanted to see the logbook. So we learned that, and I sent some undercover investigators to the fifth floor of City Hall to ask to see the logbook. The mayor's office staff said that they could not see the logbook and they'd need to send a Freedom of Information Act request for the information. So we did so, in a covert capacity, not identifying ourselves as the sender. The point there was to determine exactly, as you get at, what information would be available to a member of the public, to a Chicagoan, right? If these gifts are accepted on behalf of the city, they are by definition public property. They by definition belong to Chicagoans. So we sent this FOIA request. It was denied by delay. And then and only then did we send an official compelled OIG document request. We got back a spreadsheet which listed hundreds of gifts, including the examples you just rattled off. And it listed some of those as being located in what is called on that document a gift room. So we went back to City Hall, and this time in an overt capacity, and asked to see the gift room. The law department denied our access to that room. And so that is all to say, why does this matter? Because we have gifts of value changing hands, apparently literally in a windowless room in City Hall, with no public visibility into the source of those gifts in many cases, the circumstances under which they are accepted, whether there is anything offered in exchange, without any of that information. I talk a lot about what can go wrong in windowless rooms in City Hall. I mostly mean that as a metaphor. This is a very literal windowless room.
Only Ryan Burrow has more expensive accoutrements in his closet. The last question we'll deal with here, and by the way, I mean, so much of what you talk about deals with public perception, right? Because it's important for the public to have faith in their elected representatives. Why not just decline that gift? Why even, you know, have to put those things in a room? But we'll move on really quickly. We only have a minute left or two, but there's news out of City Hall this week about an initiative that you suggested with regards to members of extreme groups in the Chicago Police Department that harkens back to January 6th. You suggested some rules dealing with that went unacted on until just this week, right? Explain what's going on there.
That's right. So we have for years now been working on the handling of allegations that members of the police department have associated with extremist hate groups and anti-government groups. We recommended that the mayor's office convene a task force to build a whole of government approach to this problem. The mayor's office has taken that sort of approach with other complex, very important problems. And after many months of delay, the mayor's office has now apparently begun work on such a task force. I think that is good news, and I think it's long overdue.
I just want to point out, Rich, that the Statue of Liberty was a gift from France. Okay. Now, it's not being kept in a closet, but I just want to point that out. So there we go. Chicago City Inspector General Deborah Witzberg, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Rich Lenkoff is an attorney with Downey & Lenkoff, a firm with offices in Illinois, Indiana, and Wisconsin. Rich is consistently recognized by clients like McDonald's, Target, Macy's, Wendy's, and the Chicago Bears for his zealous advocacy and outstanding litigation results. Rich's many accolades include being named as an Illinois Super Lawyer from 2015 to present and leading lawyer from 2012 to present. These are designations given to less than 5% of Illinois attorneys. Rich is also an active member of his community, serving on the Legal Prep Charter Academy Advisory Board and the Northern Illinois University College of Law Board of Visitors. Rich is also a producer with credits including 85, The Greatest Team in Football History, starring Barack Obama, Bill Murray, and Mike Ditka. Renegades, a Caesar's Palace production starring Terrell Owens, Jose Canseco and Jim McMahon, Rock of Ages, and Elvis Presley's Heartbreak Hotel in concert. In addition to hosting WGN's Legal Face-Off since 2014, Rich serves as a legal analyst for a variety of media outlets. Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service litigation firm practicing general liability, workers' compensation, professional malpractice, and intellectual property, among other practice areas. For more information about Rich and Downey & Lenkoff, please visit dl-firm.com.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off with Rich Lenkoff and Tina Martini. Tina's off for the day. I'm Ryan Burr. Former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich got a presidential pardon from Donald Trump, and that could make him eligible to work in public office again, at least federally. Michael Dorff of the law offices of Michael C. Dorff, LLC, joins us to talk about that. He specializes in election law and campaign finance compliance. Thanks so much for coming on with us.
I'm glad to be here.
Michael, we know that Blagojevich was impeached because he was indicted on charges that he conspired to sell off the Senate seat of then President-elect Barack Obama. The General Assembly here in Illinois impeached him, making him the first Illinois governor to have that distinction, that unfortunate distinction. Tell us, first of all, the impeachment document says that Blagojevich is disqualified from holding any future public office of the state of Illinois. That's what it said back in 2009 when he was removed from office. Now that he's been pardoned by President Trump, what options does he have politically?
Well, he clearly can run for federal office. There's no constitutional restriction for him getting his old congressional seat back, running for the Senate. It is also absolutely clear he cannot run for a state constitutional office. So he can't run for governor again. He can't run in the General Assembly. He can't run for state judge. Where the question is can he still run for mayor of Chicago or another local office? And I think he can.
Okay, why is that? Because again, the impeachment document seems pretty clear that it says any future public office of the state of Illinois. Now that sounds like it's state only. On the other hand, hate to sound like a Clinton era lawyer, but it depends on the definition of, right? I mean, what does of the state of Illinois mean? Does that?
That's exactly right. You are absolutely right. That's where it is. And I think there is a difference between of the state of Illinois and in the state of Illinois. Of the state of Illinois traditionally means offices that are in the state constitution. And again, that's constitutional offices, General Assembly, judicial offices. I think he can run for a municipal office. The pardon takes away any disability that the Illinois Municipal Code says you can't run for municipal office if you're a convicted felon. He's not a convicted felon anymore.
All right. Now, the Supreme Court also disbarred Blagojevich in May 2020. After a state panel recommended that his law license be taken away, he can petition to reinstate in May of 2025, which is just a couple of months away, obviously. Would he be able to practice law again? What do you think of that?
I don't think so, because the Supreme Court, which has the ultimate authority over who can practice, also has a character qualification. And although the pardon took away the conviction, it does not take away the guilt. And courts have said that accepting a pardon is in many ways an acknowledgement of guilt. And I think that's a character flaw that the Illinois Supreme Court probably will not overlook.
Michael, Blagojevich is very well known to be of Serbian descent. He held a rally for Serbs for Trump at the Republican National Convention in Milwaukee. There's been some discussion that he would be appointed as ambassador to Serbia. Anything precluding him from serving in that capacity?
Only the Senate. The Senate consents and advises. He's in.
So what are your thoughts? Putting all of that aside, do we think that we'll see a run from Blago? He's been interviewed, of course, since he's been pardoned. He hasn't ruled it out. We know that he has a seemingly unsatiable appetite for being out in the public. What do you think the political future holds for our ex-governor?
He has done everything right in what the this president requires for showing fealty and obeisance and kissing the tush. And so I think there's a good chance that Trump will appoint him to some public office.
And just one more question here while we have you. I mean, this is, you know, you're obviously a veteran election law attorney, but putting on your sort of hat about public perception, what do you think the public perception is of him? Do you think that the memory is short, especially given recent verdicts, you know, including Michael Madigan? I mean, do you think there's an appetite for Blago to run again and be successful? Do you think people don't remember, you know, some of what he was convicted for, even though he was, you know, he served, I think, the longest sentence from anyone in U.S. public history for public corruption?
I agree with you. I think he wants to be back in public office. He wants to run. He says he's still a Democrat, but he's really pretty much now a Republican. So he could run either way if he decides to run for Senate or go back to Congress. I think he'd really like to run for mayor just to stick it in people's eyes. I don't think he'd be successful, but I think he'll try something.
Michael Dorff, thank you so much for joining us on Legal Face-Off.
Glad to be here.
Don't forget to listen, like, and subscribe to the Legal Face-Off podcast on social media and on WGNradio.com. Chicago, Cook County, and Illinois are being sued by the Department of Justice over its sanctuary city policies. Here to chat with us about that is Nadav Shoked, a professor of law at the Northwestern Pritzker School of Law. Thanks for jumping on with us.
Of course. Thanks so much for inviting me.
Professor, this is a 23-page lawsuit that was filed recently, as Ryan mentioned. Basically, the federal prosecutors are alleging that Chicago, Illinois, and Cook County are all violating federal immigration laws. Could you explain to us basically what the allegations are in brief?
Yes. So the allegation is that by refusing to aid federal enforcement efforts against undocumented immigrants, all three of those governments are violating federal law. And the way in which these governments are refusing to aid those agencies is by passing the state level, the county level, and the city level, sanctuary city, sanctuary county, and sanctuary state protections.
Now, what do you make of the fact that the complaint doesn't really have any specific allegations of what they are alleging? There's no examples that were given.
Yeah, so that is definitely a factual issue they have. The claim that they're pushing, which from a legal perspective is really pushing the envelope, is that by merely having these statutes and ordinances in place that allegedly stop law enforcement agents in the city, county, and state from aiding, that in and of itself is enough, because that results, for example, in the fact that when someone is apprehended or arrested or whatever by a police officer in the state of Illinois, that person is not going to be asked in most situations about their immigration status. And from the perspective of the Justice Department, that in and of itself is the interference with the federal efforts.
Professor, obviously the heart of the allegation here and the heart of this dispute is who has control over this issue? Should it be the federal government or should it be state governments? We're seeing, you know, a similar issue playing out with regards to at a smaller level, but albeit the same disagreement with in New York, right, with this congestion fee. This week, quite famously, Trump declared that the tax that the state of New York imposed on commuters coming into the city of New York, he said that tax is over. And, you know, quite notably, he said, long live the king, because he's alleging that he has the power as the head of the federal government, not as the king, but who knows, to, you know, wipe out this decision. Of course, Kathy Hochul, the governor of New York, has said, wait, hold on, that's our responsibility. That's clearly a state issue. Similarly, in this case, who controls this issue of immigration enforcement? Should it be the executive, or should it be up to the states, like in, or as states and local governments, like in Illinois?
Yes, arguably this case is actually easier from the state and city's perspective than the New York congestion tax situation, because here, actually, as far as American law goes today, now they want to change it, but as far as it stands today, there is a pretty clear cut answer to your question, and that is that the federal government controls immigration laws. So Illinois, Cook County, Chicago cannot decide who becomes an immigrant or who enters the U.S. and who becomes a citizen and who enters and who does not enter the U.S. However, police in America almost completely is controlled by the state and even more so by the localities. So who controls the Chicago Police Department? Well, the mayor of Chicago, not the president of the U.S. or the king of the U.S. So as far as that is concerned, there's a clear-cut answer, which also creates the problem that they have with their lawsuit, and that is that up to today, courts have been pretty clear that the federal government cannot force state police officers or city police officers to do anything on the federal government's behalf.
Professor, the governor of Illinois, J.B. Pritzker, said that, he mentioned the bipartisan Illinois Trust, that's capital T-R-U-S-T Act. He said that that is at play here. What is that and how is it relevant to this lawsuit?
Well, so I think that he was referring to the state level sanctuary state law, which renders Illinois into a state that just does not. Well, does not allow is a complicated term here, but where police officers are not cooperating with the federal government. So in that sense, it's Illinois is not, we're not talking here just about sanctuary cities like, say, in Chicago or Evanston, but on the whole state level. But of course, that doesn't really answer the question because from the perspective of the federal government, now I agree with the governor's analysis, which is the federal government is wrong, but from the perspective of the federal government, all these state laws are just unconstitutional under the federal constitution. So it doesn't matter that those states are on the books, you cannot enforce them. And that's at the heart of the lawsuit. And the whole debate in the lawsuit will be about, is the law constitutional or not? Again, as far as federal law stands today, the state is right. But the federal government is basically asking the court to say, no, the state is wrong. This is unconstitutional.
Professor, last question here. We've seen in the first month of the Trump presidency, at least this 2.0, he has acted first and then dealt with lawsuits second. You know, we're seeing already some of the litigation surrounding some of his executive orders play out. He won, actually won yesterday in federal court. How do you think the federal courts will look at this action, given that there seems to be some temperament for him acting in the way that he's acted with regards to some other issues? How do you think the feds will look at this one?
So I think that what's interesting about Trump 2.0 as compared to Trump 8 years ago is that the administration now is acting there's much more preparation than we saw 8 years ago. So, of course, you're completely correct in the sense that they're really swinging for the fences. But this time they're swinging for the fences with lawyers drafting their documents, unlike, say, 8 years ago. So, say, even this lawsuit, which I do think eventually will lose. So I do think that the state and the city will have the courts on their side, assuming no new factual issue pops up. If you read the lawsuit itself, yes, it's pushing the envelope, but it's doing it in a way that a lawyer would do it, in a sense of kind of admitting the fact that we're going beyond where the law currently is, not making preposterous arguments about the current law. So trying to be more radical, but within or using traditional legal arguments. So I think what's interesting about this time as compared to the last time around is that they're much more radical. This lawsuit is something that they were not bringing last time around. They were not trying to argue being a sanctuary city is unconstitutional. They were trying to just take money away from you if you were that. But at the same time, doing it with lawyers working on their side, and clearly lawyers that are rather talented. So again, pushing the envelope, but doing it in a way that does not appear as something that is just, you know, a crazy op-ed style ranting. It's actually drafted like a lawsuit.
We are expecting the Democratic Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson to testify before a Republican-led House committee on the topic of sanctuary cities coming up in early March. Nadav, thanks so much for jumping on with us today.
Thank you so much.
You are listening to Christina Martini on Legal Face-Off. Christina is a partner at McDermott, Will & Emery and focuses her practice on domestic and international trademark and copyright law, as well as domain name, internet, social media, advertising, and unfair competition law. Tina has received numerous professional accolades, including an AV preeminent rating by Martindale Hubbell and being selected for many years as one of America's leading intellectual property attorneys by various legal publications, including Chambers & Partners and World Trademark Review. Tina is also the recipient of the Anti-Defamation League's Women of Achievement Award and has been recognized by Crain's Chicago Business as one of Chicago's most influential minority lawyers. In addition to her full-time practice, Tina is an author, columnist, legal analyst, and podcast host, and she frequently shares her thought leadership with respect to current issues and trends impacting both the legal and business landscapes through various media outlets. McDermott, Will & Emery is an integrated international law firm. McDermott has an uncompromising commitment to legal excellence, extraordinary client service, and a high-performance culture. It is committed to helping clients achieve stellar legal and business results today and well into the future. To contact Tina and to learn more about McDermott, Will & Emery, visit MWE.com.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off on WGN. It's time for the Legal Grab Bag. And in this corner, we have Albert Soler of Soler & Salva, based in New York. Welcome to the program. Rich, we start with Trump Watch. We're officially a month into the new term. Do you have whiplash yet?
You know, he continues to give us content. I mean, the latest yesterday, Albert, was a federal court judge said that his mass firings, Trump's mass firings of federal employees could stand, at least for now. It was as a result of an action brought by some federal workers who were fired. The court specifically, interestingly, the judge specifically said, he mentioned words like chaos and disruption. He said that was, you know, within Trump's purview. We also, interestingly, saw the hearing yesterday in New York, resulting from the administration's pardoning, or I guess not pardoning, but dismissal of the lawsuit against, or the charges against current Mayor Eric Adams in New York. A couple of interesting takeaways from that were that it was only the acting deputy attorney general, Emil Bove, who attended this hearing, which is really unusual for the number two, attorney in the country to attend that himself. And that speaks to the idea that, you know, according to all reports and according to the resignation of the U.S. attorney there in the Northern District of New York, or the Southern District of New York, I should say, they couldn't find anyone to sign off on this dismissal. Again, you know, Eric Adams was charged with various acts of public corruption. And the Trump administration, through Emil Bove, moved to dismiss those charges. And an alleged quid pro quo, right? They said that if you pursue our immigration policies in New York, we will drop these charges against you. Now, they had to have a federal court judge sign off on that dismissal. That happened yesterday. The judge ultimately said he's going to consider it. He's not going to shoot from the hip of the words he used. But those are a couple of items that happened yesterday. In the first 30 days, that's a long windup to this question, Albert, but in the first 30 days of the Trump administration, from a legal perspective, it seems like Trump is winning, right? I mean, he is acting first and then worrying about the legal repercussions later. But at least in a couple of examples, it looks like he is winning.
Well, first of all, thanks for having me. It's always a pleasure to be here with you guys. I think one of the MOs of the administration has always been to act first, apologize later. One of the things that's always surprised me about all this, including the mayor and all these issues that are going on, is the fact that the challenges to executive power, the limits to executive power, is something that Trump's always kind of expanded, right? And I don't think the system of government was prepared for that type of executive power and the broadening of the same. So, for example, when you pardon as a quid pro quo and you're trying to get deals done on your side, on the political side. And by the way, I read, I think a little while ago, that the judge actually is appointing a special investigator. I think that happened today. So they're not going forward. They're having somebody to quote. I think the judge's words were, I'm going to appoint so-and-so to investigate, to be careful about it or to think carefully about it. So there is going to be, I think, a review on that. And that happened a little bit ago, I think, today. So at the end of the day, what I think it comes down to is he's pushing the boundaries of the executive's power. And the Constitution and scholars and everybody in law talks about this. It's never been really done before. He did it during his first term and he did it now. And the system isn't really built for that type of aggressive use of executive power. That's my view on it. And I think it'll be interesting to see what happens with this dismissal and the pardon.
And what struck me yesterday, I wasn't there, but I did read a lot of reports from those who were in the courtroom. What struck me was, you know, it seemed as though the judge, and this is a federal judge, was deferring really to, you know, Trump's lawyer. Now, there is a longstanding tradition for the prosecutors to basically decide, you know, who to charge and sometimes to drop those charges. You know, federal judges do give deference to the prosecutors. But it seemed to me as though this federal judge was, you know, almost ceding their authority to this lawyer from the administration. It seems to be consistent with a theme, which is, to your point, the executive, Trump is flexing. It all comes down to sort of whether he has the will of the people to do that. And at least according to the election, he does. We'll see how long that lasts. We'll see what kind of decisions the federal court judges come down with to see if that continues. But at least for now, he seems to be winning a couple of these arguments.
And the evidence was overwhelming, right? It's not as if it's a close call on the corruption charges. And by the way, my colleague Joe just joined us. So Joe Abraham, he's a colleague of mine, Soler Salva. Thanks for jumping on, Joe.
You're welcome. We appreciate you jumping on. And we'll just go to you maybe for this last question. Again, one of the arguments in this Mayor Eric Adams hearing yesterday that he asserted himself, in addition to his lawyers, was that, or his, you know, the Trump lawyer, was that he is not able to fully execute his powers as mayor of New York. He's not able to do his job if these charges are hanging over him. By that logic, you would never bring any criminal action against any public official. We just had the inspector general of the city of Chicago on. We just talked about, you know, various examples of public corruption. By that argument, all you would have to say, if you were Rod Blagojevich in Illinois, Michael Madigan in Illinois, Eric Adams, anyone holding public offices, hey, leave me alone.
Menendez.
Because your investigation of my acts impedes my ability to do my job. Come on.
And I'll add, I mean, I missed the beginning of this. Unfortunately, I had some technical issues jumping on. But, you know, the New York City, other officials in New York City have the ability to replace the mayor if he's incapable of doing his job. Now, the standards are very loose on how that's applied and when they have the authority to do so. But that, to me, that's grounds for the Corporation Council, I believe it's the Queens, the head of the borough chief of Queens, and several other officials who can convene a meeting to remove him from office on that basis alone.
Well, thank you so much. Welcome to the legal grab bag here. All right, our friend Antonio Romanucci, who I actually saw yesterday at the Lake County Courthouse before this story came out, he's actually going to be representing some of the victims in that Delta Airlines. I don't know, was it a crash? It was a flip over, I suppose, in Toronto. But Rich, Delta is already offering up some we're sorry money to the passengers, aren't they?
Yeah, Romanucci is a frequent guest on our show. He said, he was quoted as saying, you will see lawsuits. What a shocker. You will see lawsuits after a major corporation was involved in an accident, in this case, Delta. Yeah, the news out of that story yesterday was that they offered this $30,000. You know, in some respects, you might argue, Albert, that's a lot of money, given that there were no fatalities, thankfully, from this overturned jet at Pearson Airport in Toronto. On the other hand, of course, given the allegations of this one complaint already, I think it was a $2.5 million allegation, that's peanuts. And even though $30,000 was the max that Delta offered, it doesn't come with any strings that you can't pursue a lawsuit. It does say that by accepting it, you agree to deduct that $30,000 from your ultimate recovery. But, you know, the allegation in this one was that hanging upside down in this plane, there was airline jet fuel pouring all over them. They were suspended for, several minutes, and that was traumatizing. They're also alleging some physical injuries in that case. But listen, certainly Delta has some liability here. I'm someone who defends corporations on these kind of lawsuits. I've defended many airlines. I always take the position that, physical damages are much more significant and valuable than, you know, psychological injuries. But certainly there's some liability and Delta's going to have to pay up, I would imagine.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think obviously never to minimize what happened. Right. It's terrible and very scary, traumatizing. But when it's just from a legal matter, when you take it objectively, remember that when litigation happens, there's also a public relations component to that. And companies are well aware of that. This payment to me signifies just a good faith gesture to come out in front of the accident and say, listen, we care about you. We care about this. No strings attached. Here's something from us to show you that we're sorry about it. But I've been litigating for 22 years, and I can tell you right now, there's going to be lawsuits from every single person there. Emotional distress all the way to $10 million in damages. And again, not to minimize the accident, but one thing I don't like about litigation in this country, having seen it for so long, is that litigants are abusive. And not all the time are they unjustified, but a lot of times they try to overstep the bounds on what it's worth. Now, it is a case-by-case issue, but I, again, to answer the question, the $30,000, I think, is a public relations type of move. I think it's a smart one, show that we care. But you're going to see a flood of litigation, no matter what.
Andre, there's something called the Montreal Convention that caps recovery, but that's only in cases where you could show that you were negligent as an airline. That doesn't seem to be the case here. Again, it's not every day that you see a commercial jet airliner on its back. So certainly something went wrong here. And for sure, given the notoriety, there's going to be a lot of money paid out.
Yeah. Well, I think the experts will be able to show that this was due to just physics and aerodynamics. I mean, my understanding is that just the wind pulled from underneath in horrible weather conditions, I guess, and flipped it over. I've never seen that before either. I've never seen that. It is bizarre, but in litigation, the battle of the experts governs everything. And it's shocking how much each expert can say and contradict what the other one says. I think it'll be an expert thing. I don't think it's negligence at all. I agree with you, Rich. It's not. But we'll see what happens. People are going to go for theirs on this one. But again, not to minimize what happened, because it's shocking.
Audra, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, look, the risk is you never know how a jury is going to turn out, right? And you never know who's going to be on a jury. And if you're talking about something like this, whether the airline did absolutely nothing wrong or not, did they want to prove that in court? And are airlines in a place where they're treated, where the public looks at them favorably and will give them the benefit of the doubt? It's tough to say, and particularly in light of, you know, the tenor of the media around it, particularly in light of everything that happened with Boeing last year. I mean, if I'm the airline, I'm not focusing on fighting this whatsoever. I'm trying to pay up as little as possible and get this under the rug as quickly as possible. And that's all you can really do.
So, Rich, as the resident Canadian here, would that be 30,000 American or would that be 30,000 Canadian? Because I'm seeing right now, one Canadian dollar equals 70 U.S. cents.
I think it's up based on our tremendous victory over the Americans yesterday.
Ah, there it is. There it is.
Look, if Trump has his way, it's only going to be $1, right? Canadian and U.S. We'll see how that goes.
All right. New Jersey man's wife was killed by a rampaging hippo while on a safari in Africa. You can't sue the hippo. I mean, I guess you could, but I don't know what you'd get out of that. Rich, who's he going after?
Well, the company is based on Connecticut that, I guess, organized the safari. It's called African Portfolio. You know, not to minimize the loss that him and his family suffered. Of course, very tragic death. I got into a deep hole yesterday, Ryan, looking at a lot of hippo attack videos. I think most people like don't consider hippos all that dangerous. They're kind of like interesting looking, and you see them in the zoo. But they are among the most deadly creatures out there. They could run up to 20 miles an hour, I discovered. They're obviously incredibly huge and powerful. They've got, you know, really powerful jaws. I saw lots of video of hippos versus elephants and zebras, and inevitably the hippo wins. Hippos are great swimmers, too, it turns out. There's lots of videos of hippos attacking boats. You know, we've seen lots of high-profile examples, Aja, over the last few years. We've covered a lot of these stories of safaris gone wrong. From a legal perspective here, what we're looking at is to what degree is the safari company responsible when, you know, an animal, a wild animal at a trip that you agree, you know, you're going to be in the middle of a jungle somewhere dealing with animals, what degree are they responsible? Now, they're saying that the guide left them alone and, you know, they were alone in this area, and that's when the hippo attacked. The company has not responded yet. But again, as someone who defends these kind of lawsuits all the time, there's some degree of personal responsibility, right? Putting aside what inevitably will be, I assume there's a waiver. I assume there's a long waiver. I don't know what degree Connecticut enforces those waivers. But the idea behind a waiver is that you understand that by embarking on a safari by going in the middle of a jungle with wild animals, there's some high degree of risk. And that's on you rather than this company. The company said, all we do is organize, you know, this trip. We're not really responsible for what happens on the trip. So it'll be interesting to see if this ever goes to, you know, to a jury, whether the jury will put more liability on the company or on the fault of the couple who decided to, you know, embark on this and didn't have to go on this trip, you know, surrounded by wild animals. Ajay, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, look, I totally agree with you. Again, I'm not licensed in Connecticut, only New Jersey and New York, but I would imagine that the Connecticut rules are pretty comparable. You know, there are waivers everywhere. Everyone signs a waiver, but if you are grossly negligent, there's the waivers rarely apply and the companies are still liable. So the question is going to be, what is grossly negligent for a safari company? I mean, and beyond that, you know, the actual facts of what happened on that day, like who was there, who can prove their case in this kind of situation? I mean, the animal is definitely not going to testify and let us know why it went crazy and attacked, you know,
to that point, actually, you know, what struck me in the lawsuit, Albert, and sometimes, you know, you read lawsuits and, you know, you wonder sort of how they were written. What struck me is that it says, according to the lawsuit, without warning, the hippo lifted its head and charged out of the water towards Lisa Manders. Without warning, what kind of warning would a hippo give? Like, right. Hey, everyone, right. Get ready. I'm going to lift my 2-ton head out of the water and attack you. I mean, that's kind of a preposterous statement, no?
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. I mean, again, it's a huge loss, right? We know that. But this is an assumption of risk case, right? And I see these all the time. And you're assuming the risk of the activity, but like Ajay mentioned, the gross negligence is an exception to that, right? Now, here's kind of what bothers me about this. And remember, there was that case a while back in Florida where the young boy was at one of the Disney properties, I believe, and he walked by the river, the water, the pond, and an alligator actually, I believe, killed him. And there the idea was that there was not even signage, that there were alligators possibly in that. That's a different case. To me, that's a more clear-cut type of gross negligence where you wouldn't even know that it was there underwater, right? This is a little bit different. However, remember what you said, Rich, at the beginning of this segment, which was, I didn't know that hippos could run 20 miles an hour, that they were fast in the water, and that they attack like that. Well, I didn't know that until I read this. So if I'm the other side, I'm saying, listen, the fact that how many of you knew that, nobody knew it, so it was negligent, highly negligent, to not inform somebody, even with a waiver, that that could happen. And then you have the issue of the actual tour guide leaving. If the attack happened, could he put him down? Could he have had a weapon to prevent his death? I think so. I don't know enough about it. So assumption of risk is correct and true. However, there are limits to it. And just the facts here are very bizarre. It's not okay for the company, and there is also a question of standing, who's the right company to sue, right? But the issue of the guide who you're putting your kind of trust in when it comes to at least guiding them through the tour and the process, leaving. To me, that's grossly negligent. And once the hippo attacked, it was game over. So yeah, she signed the release. I'm sure it was a 20-page release like they have in other similar type of things. But I do think that this death, that they're going to get something. You'll probably be able to prove gross negligence on this one.
Funny that you bring that up, Albert. I was actually in Disney when that alligator ended up.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. I was at the Polynesian. That happened at the Grand Floridian. It was right there. Helicopters flying overhead. It was a wild time to be there.
But not even a sign, huh? Remember, not even a sign.
You know, they put up the signs the exact next day and we could not dip our toes any further in the water. It was wild.
Crazy.
And yeah, you wouldn't find a lot of news about that, though, in the greatest place, you know,
oh, that's right.
Magical place in the world.
Politics at work.
Yes. The latest in the Lively Baldoni drama, Rich, Blake Lively says other women raised concerns about Justin Baldoni on the set of It Ends With Us.
I mean, we cover the story now almost every episode. It is a high profile story. Very interesting. Again, this is Justin Baldoni, who is the co-star and director of the film It Ends With Us. Blake Lively, who was the star, the lead of that film, has alleged in actually more than one proceeding that she was sexually harassed on that set, that she was forced to engage in acts that she did not consent to. She alleges that there was no intimacy coordinator on the film. Lots of allegations. Justin Baldoni has countersued against the New York Times, alleging defamation, also against Ryan Reynolds and Blake Lively for their statements. So this is a huge Hollywood feud that continues to get bigger. Again, to your point, this week, Blake Lively added 50 pages of allegations to her complaint, alleging that not only was she the victim of Baldoni, but that many other women on the set were made uncomfortable, were abused by him. Also, as an aside, we could talk about this as well. It's been widely criticized. Ryan Reynolds has been widely criticized for making a joke about this. Apparently on the SNL 50 on Sunday night, there was a special and he stood up in the audience and they asked him, I think, what was going on. And he said something like, "Nothing. What have you heard?" To me, that wasn't necessarily, you know, referencing this lawsuit, but many online have criticized him as making light of these allegations. If you're alleging that your wife was victim of a sexual, you know, sexual abuse, sexual harassment, why would you make light of it? Back to this point, Albert, we've seen this strategy before, right? It's not uncommon, especially with celebrities, to not just allege that you were victim of sexual abuse, sexual harassment, but that others were. We saw that in the Bill Cosby case, right? They were able to negate the statute of limitations or overcome that because they were able to, you know, bring forward additional women. They were able to show that Bill Cosby had a modus operandi that allowed that evidence in. We're seeing it right now with Justin Tucker, right? The future Hall of Fame kicker for the Baltimore Ravens. Even though they go back many years, there's allegations that he abused people engaged in physical therapy and massages. So it seems that the more people who allege a certain act in this area, certainly it adds credibility to the allegation. What are your thoughts of Blake Lively adding these pages to her amended complaint?
I mean, first of all, I do a lot of work in entertainment. I deal with celebrities all the time. It's a different world, right? We have a mix of law, court, cases, also public perception, fans. So it's one of those where if you look, for example, how Jay-Z handled his accusations, he went full board aggressive. I thought it was a good strategy because if you have nothing to hide, you go full out. I'm going to take everyone down. It's unjust. It's defamation, blah, blah, blah. Perfect. But here's the thing, though, that those allegations, they're very, very serious, and they have the ability to really defame and destroy the reputation of the one who's being accused. We have some litigation now that's going on where it touches on these types of issues, and it's unfair to the defendant, especially when there's no evidence of it. Now, I'm not saying that one's right, one's wrong. I think by adding the additional complaints, you're doing what Jay-Z did, which is, look, I'm right. I'm going to continue to hit you with it. And when you have money, you can do that. One of my complaints about the legal system in litigation is that it's far too expensive. And it is true, in my opinion, that deep pockets have a better shot to kind of bully and maneuver a lot more than normal folks can who may not have the deep pockets. That's something that I don't like about litigation, having done it for 2 decades. So you add the claims to make it more of a defensive. I'm so right. Here's another 50, right? And I'm going to keep going and not back down. What is interesting about this that I never understood about litigants is Baldoni, if he says that he didn't do that, but he has a lot of text messages where he is saying, "I'll change it. Thank you for bringing it up. You know, yes, I have to change some things." But you don't realize for everyone that's litigating, every single text message, email, everything on your phone is discoverable. In all of our cases, we have forensic images of every single text you've ever sent. So the other side can then create this issue that if it wasn't happening, why would you have to fix anything, right? So I think that that's going to be an issue for Baldoni. But on the other hand, you're going to have similar evidence against Blake Lively as well. As for the SNL thing, there's nothing there. People are way too sensitive about it. The host asked him, "Well, how are you doing?" And he said, "What? Did you hear anything?" I thought it was actually funny. It wasn't meant to be mean or hurtful. I think it was making light of something that's become national news. That's what I think.
Great. All right, moving along. ChatGPT-ing and lawyering apparently don't mix, as some attorneys are finding out. Rich.
A couple cases of lawyers making up, or lawyer, it's an interesting way to phrase it. Lawyers using cases that don't exist as a result of ChatGPT research. But this is a very prominent case because it involves a firm that, if you do what I do, which is a lot of which is personal injury defense, you've heard of Morgan & Morgan. They call themselves the 42nd ranked firm in the country based on headcount. On their website, they're called America's largest injury law firm. Them and a couple other firms were sanctioned by a judge for using not just one case, Ajo, but 9 cases that they cited that look to the naked eye as proper citations with names and, you know, sites and all that stuff that we use, but that just don't exist. They were filing, they were pursuing a motion in limine, which is really an innocuous motion. I mean, it's something we file all the time in preparing for trial, and they decided to use ChatGPT, I guess. You would understand perhaps in some of the other cases, not that it's okay, but, you know, maybe a smaller firm with less resources. That's the excuse that some other firms that have been caught using ChatGPT for this purpose. But the 42nd firm in the country, America's largest injury law firm, you can't find cases of your own that are actual cases. That seems rough.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question. I feel like we're going to come across this a lot more and more as the technology develops. It's lazy lawyering at the end of the day, you know, a combination of lazy lawyering and overstuffed dockets. Like some of these attorneys, I'm guessing, and, you know, nothing against any of these attorneys personally. I don't know them. I'm just saying, generally speaking, you know, the personal injury law firms have to have a lot of cases. That's just how they work. They're constantly trying to settle as many as possible. It's a numbers game. And when you do that, you lose some of the ability to practice law with, you know, artistry and to actually put effort into the work that you're doing. It becomes a mill. And you try to find shortcuts, and it happens. And that's what we're dealing with here in this situation. The courts are going to punish them. And that's all that's going to happen. They're going to get sanctioned hard. There's not really a justification or an excuse. You filed it and it's clear. It's not real. I mean, the judge ordered them to provide copies of the cases last I saw. If it's real, what's going to happen? They're not going to be able to provide anything, and they're going to get sanctioned. You hate to see it, but anytime new technology comes out like that, you know, it's a warning. It's a lesson to all other attorneys. You know, we're still a profession that has to answer and has ethical responsibilities and duties. And part of that involves reading every case and doing the work, even if you've done it 1,000 times, you know.
This is why, to our listeners and viewers, this is why you still need to hire people like us. Robots, so hire us.
All right. Well, it sounds like Meghan Markle, the actress and Duchess of Sussex, wants to rebrand herself, but the new identity isn't sitting well with the New York vintage clothing designer.
Well, she announced plans, Ryan, to call her new lifestyle brand. I don't know what it was called before, but she wants to now call it As Ever, which, to the point of our story, is also the name of a company called As Ever NYC, owned by an individual who announced that he's talking to lawyers about what to do. The key, Albert, to these questions, and, you know, if our IP guru Tina was on, she would tell you, is you can't confuse the public, right? And in this case, because this is a lifestyle brand and he specializes in reworked vintage clothing from around New York and New Jersey, I suppose that some of what Meghan Markle will be selling won't lead to confusion, but some of it will. So you would think that, I don't know, she has the resources maybe to do a little research and, you know, pick a different name, or maybe she did and just doesn't care because she is, after all, the former Duchess of Sussex.
Yeah. So I have 2 decades in IP, so I can speak to this. So here, what it is people have to remember, what is a trademark? It's a source identifier. What does that mean? It means that the public identifies the quality of a good and service to your brand. That's all it is. Right. When I buy something from, for example, Coca-Cola, I know I'm going to get certain quality, most likely. Right. It's going to taste a certain way, look a certain way. When I buy Christian Louboutin shoes, they're going to look a certain way with the red on the bottom. They're going to identify the quality. So what happens here, what matters here, is that the prior mark, not Meghan Markle's, but the other user, is called a senior user. That means that he has been using that mark prior to her filing. A senior user, especially a senior user who has a registered mark, who registered the trademark, has a lot of power. And he has the power to exclude every other subsequent user who may have the exact or similar mark. Why? Because when you allow that to happen, there's a likelihood of confusion between the quality and source of the goods. In this case, what happens a lot is I don't think she'll file it because any simple search will reveal the prior mark. And the prior mark has seniority. It doesn't matter that she sells vintage and he sells modern clothes. It doesn't make a difference. Trademarks are filed by class. So in this case, class 25 is clothing and apparel. and both of them are in the same class. So it doesn't matter that one's vintage or not. It matters that they sell tops, bottoms, shirts, hats, whatever that category might be. Typically what happens here is that somebody like Meghan Markle, should she want that mark, she could always purchase the entire enterprise from the prior holder. Another thing that they could do is can do a licensing agreement. I do those all the time. It's a good way. And actually, I think it'd be great for the prior user if he identifies with her and if he appreciates what she does and her brand. You can do a licensing deal where they can both use the name and do this, or special collection, capsule collections, whatever it might be. But just as a trademark matter, the fact that he filed a mark and had it first gives him rights. Even if he didn't file, he has what's known as common law rights for the same reason that he's a senior user of the mark and that customers have identified the mark with him. So she's going to have an uphill battle because, in my opinion, it is confusing. It's too close. So I don't think that she'll obtain that mark. We'll see what happens.
All right, last topic in the grab bag here. Serial laterals are no longer a deal breaker in your industry. Rich, explain serial laterals.
It used to be that firm hopping was a problem, right? I mean, Ajo, Albert, we all work for law firms. We've been around for a while. And I think from our generation, when you would skip from firm to firm, that was a real detriment to your advancement. One of the things that you look at on a resume is how long you've been at your current place of employment and how long you were at last one. And generally, you don't want to see someone who every couple of years has wanderlust and moves to a new firm, because that means that they'll be less likely to stay with you. But that is becoming a thing of the past. According to this one study from American Lawyers 2025 Laterals Report, which looks at AmLaw 200 hiring data, it is more common than ever to hire people who not just move from one job to another, but are on three or four other jobs, right? According to this data, the most recent data was from 2024 comparing 2018. In 2018, about 3% of moves represented the third lateral move from a respondent. That changed to 2024, 21%. I mean, that's a huge jump from 3% of people having three jobs to 21%. That's almost a fifth of the workforce, over a fifth of the workforce, having at least two moves. And when you look at from that point, four lateral moves went from zero in 2017, zero. That's pretty significant, to 5% in 2024, people having four moves. So I think it speaks to the difference in sort of generations. And it's a lot more common now to jump from firm to firm. You don't have as much loyalty. You don't have as much feeling that I'm somewhere and I got to stick it out. There's a lot more demand for lawyers, right? A lot of this is supply and demand. If there wasn't such demand for lawyers, then this wouldn't happen. But, everyone's looking for good lawyers, and it's not as big a hindrance to success if you're moving around firms. Ajo, is this a good development or a bad development? What are your thoughts?
Well, I mean, it's tough to say whether it's good or bad, because it depends on whose perspective we're looking at, right? From the lawyer's perspective, it's obviously good, because you're jumping for a reason. You're getting paid more. You're increasing the value. You're recognizing your own value. And if you're not satisfied with what you're getting from where you are, you can easily go to the next place and obtain that. And the market is setting the price for what your services are worth. From a client's perspective, is that necessarily good? Tough to say. I mean, the market prices are increasing as a result of that. And also, there is inherent instability that comes in the practice when attorneys are constantly switching, particularly in litigation, where you need to see a case through. You can't constantly have attorneys swapping in. So good or bad? Tough to say. What it is a reflection of the market and the cultural change, and the power that the individual attorneys have, which they might not have had when the market was more consolidated and conservative, in the sense that there were only a couple of firms and the firms were taking the same people and they're not changing much and they're sticking with that. And the partnerships were developing in a certain way. I mean, it's really difficult to predict what legal partnerships are going to look like in 10 to 15, 20 years for a number of reasons, not just these kind of switching, but, AI and professionals in general. It's hard to predict. And at the end of the day, the market is going to dictate what it dictates, and we have to adjust accordingly.
Recently, we see this issue being attempted to be dealt with by putting restrictions on how one leaves. Now, we know that in the legal profession, you can't, get a contract. You can't tell someone that they've got to stay with you, because the loyalty is to the client first and foremost. But there has been an increase in this industry to the circumstances surrounding how you leave. Do you think we'll see an increase on that given this data?
I mean, I don't, you know, I think the issue of loyalty and whether you stay or go at a firm, whether it's big, medium, or small, really has to do with how valued you are, right? And I don't think a relationship works when you as an attorney feel not valued by your firm or undervalued by your firm, and then they try to keep you there by force. It's kind of like in sports, right? If I play for the Lakers and I'm being treated incorrectly, I don't want to be there by force. Why? Because I'm not going to play well, right? So if I'm at a firm that I don't want to be at where I feel undervalued, then I'm not going to play well, quote unquote, right? I'm not going to do my job to the best of my ability. But I do think that while they try to maybe put more restrictions, they really can't do that. They can't prevent you from doing it. I think what needs to happen is the idea of loyalty has to come back, right? A lot of these lateral moves, like Joe mentioned, is because you feel like there's a better deal for you. And by deal, it's usually money, but it's also how you're being treated, right? If you feel valued and appreciated, you'll stay. If not, you'll move on. That's kind of the world that we're in right now. It's not like the olden days, you stayed a firm for 30 years. It has to make sense for you, both from a emotional and treatment perspective, as well as finances and money. So we'll see what happens.
All right, we'll end off today. We mentioned, we always like to end off with a question that tells us a little bit about yourself. We mentioned SNL. SNL 50 happened over the weekend. Ryan Reynolds and Blake Lively were both there. What about telling us your favorite SNL skits, like a skit or a character? You got 50 years to choose from. So, Aja, let's start with you. What's your favorite SNL skit or character of all time?
Celebrity Jeopardy, Sean Connery is my favorite. Every one of them, anytime he's on there, you know, the actor plays Sean Connery. I've watched it a dozen times and I'll watch it again until the day I die, probably.
You would impress it of him.
I like that. I love the cowbell one with Will Ferrell. I can't get enough of that one. I really like that a lot. I also like that character, Stefan. I think it's Bill Hader when he does this. I think it's really funny. And in general, when they break, I think it's really, really funny. But it's a great show. But that's the one I like. I like that cowboy one, the cowbell one a lot.
Oh, cowbell. Ryan Brooke, favorite SNL skit character?
Gotta be Matt Foley. End up in a van down by the river.
Price divorce.
Just watch how he, like, no one can, like, hold it in when he's doing it. It's just, it's hilarious.
He was great. What a legend. Yeah, I like him a lot. That's a good call.
Thrice divorced.
I tried to do the Sean Connery voice, and I just didn't want to embarrass myself.
I'm a huge SNL fan. I got so many. I mean, I'm going to mention two. Of course, apropos to our show, Unfrozen Caveman Lawyer, Phil Hartman, you can't do any better than that. I'm just a caveman. I don't understand your modern society. Is if a man slips and falls in a grocery store, he's entitled to treble damages. That's a good one. But all, you know, my all-time favorite, not just because it's a Chicago thing, but Michael Jordan famously hosted SNL, and he was in a film. It was one of the early films, and it was he played Sweet River Baines, and he was the first African-American Harlem Globetrotter. And before he was on Globetrotters, it was Lily White, according to the narration. And he comes in with his devil moves, and everyone's booing him, you know, because he's dunking and he's putting up 70 points on people. And it's great. It's also great.
I thought you were going to go with, I'm good enough, I'm smart enough, and doggone it, people like me.
People like me.
Although I just saw a clip from Sandler. He was talking about when Jordan hosted, and he said there was a rule. Lorne Michaels came around and said, stop bugging MJ for autographs, because everyone was constantly putting balls and stuff to sign. But yeah, great stuff. Lisa Morella, do you want to give us your favorite SNL moments?
My favorite one was Peyton Manning with the United Way when he was harassing those kids and being so mean to them.
That started his post-NFL career.
Who it did.
That time that he was funny. It then resulted in him making now tens of millions of dollars in endorsements since then. But that was the start of it. Morella, you're a little bit young, but you probably are a fan of SNL.
I actually was a couple of years back. There was this one skit making fun of the OC. I think it was called the OC, where they were acting like they were Californians and they were referring to interstates as like the I-15 and all that stuff. That was my favorite.
They just did the VW commercial during the skit. What are you doing?
Yeah, exactly.
I took the I-5 to the 280. And, yeah, that's a good one.
and then getting hyper local with the traffic references. It's fantastic. All right.
I thought Eddie Murphy was great on the 50th show. It was nice to see a really funny Eddie Murphy again, because he had a lull where he's kind of like did big movies, but I thought he was really great in the skits last thing.
Yeah, he did that because at the 40th, he just, you know, came out and wasn't funny, and that was like a huge upset. So I agree.
Rich, did you go SNL over NBA All-Star Game?
Oh my God, of course. I mean, I thought the special wasn't great. I thought it wasn't very good, but I did watch it. Unwatchable NBA All-Star Game. I mean, I can't even believe they're still holding that debacle.
That's embarrassing. It's so boring and commercial and annoying. Man, they need to bring the other commissioner back, I'm telling you. I thought it was a better show before, right? Yeah, I agree. I didn't like it. I stopped watching it, actually.
They'll get it sorted out, I'm sure. All right, well, that'll do it for this latest installment of Legal Face-Off on WGN. Of course, special thanks there to Joe Abraham and Albert Soler. We had attorney Michael Dorf of Michael C. Dorf LLC, Northwestern Law Professor Nadav Shoked, Chicago City Inspector General Deborah Witzberg, and also shouts out to Ben Anderson and Lisa Stiegel. For Tina Martina, who's on assignment this week, and Rich Lenkov, I'm Ryan Burrow. Thanks again for joining us on Legal Face-Off on WGN.
It's Christina Martini and Rich Lenkov. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face-Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab, so hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question, just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Covering sports, Hollywood, and don't forget...